episode 590 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about the first five issues of Black Eyed Kids from writer Joe Pruitt and artist Simon Kradansky. We've got colors from Guy Major and letters from Marshall Dillon. So this is a really, really great series. I've mentioned maybe when I first started talking about it a few years ago how this is really the series that kind of made me realize that horror comics can be really, really good. Up until this time, I didn't really read much horror. Since then, there have been a few titles that I've checked out that I've really enjoyed. I'll specifically mention Witches from Scott Snyder, which is another really great kind of horror title. And it's just, when done right, when it's not just gratuitous blood and violence and whatever, and kind of slasher film-ish, it can be done really, really well. A lot of suspense, very taut drama, and really compelling read. So Black Eyed Kids is a story about a family who is being affected by this black-eyed children phenomenon. And it's somewhat of an urban legend. These evil kids that have these blacked out pupils and recruit other children, usually from the age of 6 to 16, to their cause, so to speak. So in the first issue, we see the black-eyed kids for the first time. We meet a family where a mother, Jessica, is called upstairs by her daughter, Riley, because her brother, Michael, is sleepwalking, constantly sleepwalking into her room. And always seems to be in a trance. And at one point, he's in her room looking out the window. And when Jessica goes there to wake him up, he mutters, "They're coming." And she wonders, what does he mean? And Riley says, "He keeps saying that over and over. It's freaking me out." And Jessica says, "Well, be quiet, Riley. You're not helping matters." But Michael, who's coming? We also see another black-eyed child kill a couple of people in a convenience store and then sit outside the store and just wait for the police to show up, which seems really strange. We also meet Jim, who is Jessica's ex-husband and the father of Riley and Michael. He owns a pawn shop, and he notices the black-eyed kids kind of wandering around at night, in the dark, in the cold, in the snow, and just wonders how creepy that is, right? Because he just sees the kids. He doesn't realize that they have the black eyes. And later in the story, we see Jessica asking for help from either Riley or Michael to bring in the groceries. Ends up seeing Michael talking to two other boys outside, but when she confronts him about it, he acts like she's crazy. Like, "Who was I talking to? What are you talking about? There was nobody here. I'm just helping you bring in the groceries." We also see that Michael and Riley's father has a next door neighbor, Paul, who is friendly with Jim, and Jim talks about taking Riley and Michael away camping for the weekend and asks Paul if he can pick up his mail and keep an eye on the house, and Paul agrees. And later that night, there's a knock at the door, and Paul goes and answers, and it's two young boys saying they're lost. They need to call for a ride. Can we use the phone? And Paul says, "I guess the phone's in the kitchen straight back." But the boys don't walk in to use it. They ask, "Can we come in?" And Paul's like, "Yeah, that's the only way you're going to be able to use it," which is interesting. We're going to come back to that question from these black-eyed children. But what happens is the boys walk in to use the phone. And as Paul's telling them, "You can use the phone inside, but then you're going to have to wait outside. I'm sorry." One of the boys looks up for the first time, and Paul sees that his eyes are blacked out, and the other boy says, "You are needed." Meanwhile, the story shifts back to the home of Frank and Jessica, and once again, Michael has sleptwalked into Riley's room, and Riley calls down for her parents, "Hey, you know, stepdad and mom, somebody come up here and get this guy out of here again." And Frank and Jessica are talking about whose turn it is to go up there. And before either one can go, they hear a shunk, shunk. They both run to the foot of the stairs, with Frank continuing up to the top of the stairs. And when he gets there, he says, "No." And there's another shunk, shunk. And as Jessica is waiting at the bottom of the stairs, she sees blood begin to drip down the stairs. She sees Michael standing at the top of the stairs, knife in hand, as she whispers, "Michael, what have you done? And Michael says, one more must die. And we see an outside shot of the house with another shunk, shunk. Then we see a knock at the door, and the boys have returned. These are the two boys that Michael was talking to in the driveway earlier, and they ask, is it done? Michael says that it is, and the boys deem him worthy as the three walk off into the snow. Meanwhile, the boy that shot the people at the convenience store is picked up by the police, and the two policemen are commenting how strange it is that he killed these guys for seemingly no reason and then just sat there waiting for the police to arrive. And as we get a closer look at him, we see that his pupils are blacked out as well. So interesting why one of these black-eyed children would want to be captured like that. So as the story continues in issue two, it's 1:17. Jim gets a call. The number's his ex-wife's, and he wonders why she would be calling so late. But it's actually the authorities calling from Jessica's phone. And he learns about the tragedy that has befallen his family, finds out that his son is missing, his daughter is in ICU, and his ex-wife is dead. His current wife or girlfriend, Laura, is there as well, and she's very surprised by the news. And as they head to the hospital, Jim says, this is something I need to do on my own. He's brought along a teddy bear that was her favorite thing to give her to hope to reach her, but asks Laura to stay outside the room, and this is something that he needs to do on his own. So he walks in, he puts the bear beside Riley, and then puts his head in his hands, just feeling helpless. Meanwhile, at a shopping mall nearby, Meredith Williams, an author, is finishing up a signing, and as she heads to the parking garage to put away her supplies, she notices a couple of boys sitting out on the curb in the snow, and her heart goes out to them. She asks what they're doing sitting out there in that weather, and they say, we've been on our own for a long time now, and Meredith says, oh, you must be hungry. Have you had anything to eat? And the boys look up and say, we're starving, and we realize that they to have blacked out pupils. Meanwhile, Jim has returned home. He sees that Paul's truck is in the driveway and the door is open, and he wants to let him know about the tragedy that befell his family and that he won't actually be going camping that weekend as he originally planned and had told Paul. And he also wants to know if Paul will keep an eye on his house, because he imagines that him and Laura will be spending most of their time at the hospital in the coming days. But the house is dark, but he does see Paul sitting on the sofa at a very strange angle. And he's like, Paul, are you okay? And as he approaches, Paul's eyes open, and we see that Paul's pupils are blacked out as well, which shocks Jim. As he backs up, the scene shifts to the house next door, where there's a knock at the door, and Laura opens to see Michael and his two friends there, and she's very relieved to see him. She attempts to hug him and says, we were so worried about you, and we heard about your mom and your stepdad and your sister. Where have you been? What happened? Who are these boys with you? And Michael responds, I'll tell you everything, but first, can we come in? So again, it's that idea that these kids can't just come in uninvited, right? Almost like a vampire, perhaps. They need to be invited in to have any sort of power or ability to harm. So meanwhile, next door, Jim's standing on the front porch thinking, I just saw Paul this morning. I can't believe this happened. He hears a scream from next door, recognizes it as Laura, runs to his truck, grabs the gun he keeps under the front seat before and a baseball bat from the back of the truck, and then heads in, sees that it's Michael, and says, are you okay? And one of the other boys says, Michael, your father's all that's left of this life, and you know what must be done. And Michael says, yes, same as mother. And that's all Jim needs to hear. He starts swinging his bat at one of the other boys, who's able to grab it. Jim is shocked by this. It seems impossible that he could have grabbed this bat that Jim was swinging with all his strength. But the boy flings both Jim and the bat across the room. Jim is saying, Michael, this isn't you. And the boy responds that he's no longer your son. He's one of us, and he's embracing erasing his past, rather, so he can embrace his future. So Jim realizes that they've got to get out of there. And as Michael approaches him, he grabs the bookshelf next to him and throws it down in front of Michael to prevent him from approaching him. Jim then pulls out his gun and shoots one of the other boys, who falls, but then immediately opens his eyes and begins to rise. Jim grabs Laura, tells her to run. As they reach the front door, Paul is there blocking the way. So with a quick swipe of the bat, they knock Paul out of the way and jump in the truck. And Laura's just worried about them leaving Michael behind. But Jim says, "Don't you get it? Michael killed them. He killed Jessica, Frank. He tried to kill his own sister. Whatever that is back there, it's not my son." Meanwhile, Meredith has been kidnapped by the two boys she attempted to help that were sitting out in the snow. They've brought her somewhere to see someone. And when she asks who, and they take her inside what looks to be kind of an abandoned barn of some sort, a very small boy says, "That would be me." And she wants to know why she's been brought there. And the boy says, "Well, because you're a writer, a chronicle of stories, and you have this desire to be immortal in a way, to tell a story of importance. And I'm going to allow you to tell the story of the downfall of humanity. It'll be your legacy, because we've been here all along." And Laura's like, "What do you mean by that?" And he says, "Well, we're something that's beyond your comprehension. And we've been observing for a long time. We've learned your strengths. We've learned your weaknesses. And we've been preparing for the proper moment." And Laura says, "Well," Meredith rather says, "What moment is that?" And he says, "Well, the moment to strike, of course. You know, this world you think of as yours, but it's not. You're just cows that graze upon it." And he says, "Yeah, let's go with that metaphor, right? You can think of us as the ranchers, the farmers. And dairy cattle are used for nourishment, and draft cattle are bred for labor, and beef cattle are, well, you've had steak before. So our time is now. We're the farmers, you're the cattle, and you'll either serve us, work for us, or feed us. But your time is over. Your race is dead. They just don't know it yet." So interesting that this boy, this leader, it seems, of the Black Eyed Kids wants Meredith to chronicle, have a written testament of the arrogance and ignorance of the downfall of man. And so Meredith says, "Well, I don't believe you." And the boy raises his hands and waves them forward. And we see many, many children come out of the shadows to surround both the young boy, the young leader of the Black Eyed Kids, as well as Meredith. And he says, "Well, it doesn't really matter if you believe us or not, because we're coming. We're here." So that's the way issue 2 ends. Issue 3 starts with a flashback. We see a young girl being awakened by her mother, who says it's time, and she's taken outside on a very windy day. Leaves are blowing. We see many children holding hands of parents being taken somewhere. And we see this little girl approach a man, and the man says, "Hello, princess, are you ready for this? Are you ready to change the world?" And the girl responds, "Yes, daddy, I'm ready." And as she looks beyond her father, she sees a young boy. And then we realize that this young girl is Meredith, as she wakes up from a dream screaming, "Ricky." The young leader of the Black Eyed Kids is in her room as she's slept on this cot, and he wants to know who Ricky is. And she says, "No one of importance. It's just an old memory, one I'd all but forgotten." And the boy responds, "Interesting, perhaps a discussion for a future time. But for now, I've got something to show you." And he shows Meredith an old typewriter and some paper and says, "This is what you'll use to chronicle the downfall of man." And Meredith's like, "Are you serious? What about the stone tablets and chisels? You want me to write the chronicle of the fall of man using these antiques? You know, you ever hear of a computer? I have a laptop at home if you'd let me retrieve it." And the boy's immediately suspicious and says, "A word of advice, never forget you're a cow and I decide what type of cow. So unless you want to be something else, reassigned as it were, I would speak to me in a different way with respect. Are we clear?" And Meredith says, "Yes, very." And the boy then summons a companion and says, "Take her to retrieve her laptop. Keep an eye on her. Don't allow her to have contact with anyone else. She's not what she seems." Meanwhile, Jim and Laura have gone to his pawn shop, where they're looking for supplies. weapons, ammunition, and Laura takes the opportunity to search the internet about black-eyed children. And all of a sudden, she's coming across all these stories. And Jim says, well, the internet, it's got to be true if you find it on there. And Laura's like, don't be ridiculous. But there are a lot of stories about these black-eyed children, right? It's an urban legend that's been around for years, and it's all over the world too. Mostly in the States, but all over. There's hundreds of links and stories. And Jim's like, well, why haven't I heard about it before? And Laura's like, well, I can't really answer that, but you know what happens when someone claims to see Bigfoot or UFO? They're ridiculed, ostracized. And until last night, would you have believed someone had told you an encounter about children with black eyes? And he's like, no, of course not. She's like, well, there you go. You answered your own question. And as Laura's scrolling through the pages, Jim sees someone he recognizes and says, there, stop. I know that guy. It's his ex-wife, Jessica's first husband named Reese Andrews. And Jim says, you know, I think we need to find him. On the next page, we see Officer Jones has arrived at Paul's house. He's gotten a call from Paul's sister. She says she hasn't been able to reach him in 2 days, and they want to make sure that he's okay. And Officer Jones goes ahead and heads into the house because the front door is wide open. He sees blood in the living room. He sees bloody footprints in the kitchen, broken dishes. He follows the footprints outside, and in the backyard, he sees the desiccated corpse of Paul. So it's interesting. It's only been a couple days, but he seems to have burned up from the inside. He seems to have been dead for a lot longer, and you wonder if it has something to do with adults being possessed by whatever this is that turns the pupils black. The kids are, for whatever reason, able to remain alive, and that's why we see black-eyed kids, but not black-eyed adults. I mean, it's speculation at this point, but it is interesting that that it is just black-eyed kids. So while he's in the backyard, Officer Jones notices the house next door. This would be Jim and Laura's house. Their back door's open. So he heads over there to see what's going on, finds the wreckage there, the blood, the overturned bookcase. And as he's looking around, he gets a call on his radio saying, Randy, are you there? And he says, yeah, I'm here. And they say, we just got a call about a boy's dog having a crushed larynx. You want to check it out? And Randy says, man, negative. I've got a deceased body here. I'm going to need backup. The dogs can wait. And then he muses to himself, dogs being choked to death, kids shooting up gas stations, dead bodies in backyards. What is going on? Meanwhile, at the county jail, we see a couple of inmates arguing with each other. One seems to be bullying the other and telling him that he's the baddest guy in there. And if the younger boy or smaller boy wants to survive, he best not forget it. But the boy that we saw who killed the two in the convenience store, he makes his presence known and walks up to the bully and says, in response to the bully's question of what do you want, he says, you. And he takes off his glasses and shows off his black pupils. Meanwhile, Meredith has arrived at her home with the escort the black-eyed leader has sent with her. And she says her laptop's in her bedroom, goes to retrieve it, but she actually grabs a pair of scissors that she attacks the boy with and attempts to run outside. But the leader suspected it all along. He's followed, and he's there holding Meredith's cat along with a companion. And the boy says, you lied to me. The laptop was in your car all along. You must take me for a fool, as he smashes the laptop to the ground and says, I warned you there would be consequences. He hands the cat to his companion, who breaks its back, and Laura screams, no, but the boy says, disappoint me again, and it'll be your neck that breaks. Do you understand me a little more clearly now, as he backhands Meredith? So meanwhile, at the pawn shop, Jim and Laura are stocking up with a few more bullets and a few more supplies, and it looks like Jim's idea is to get out of town to look for Reese. But before they do that, they've got to go and retrieve Riley, because although the black-eyed bastards have his son and they're killing off Jim's family, he's going to protect Riley because he believes that that's where Michael will head to next. So meanwhile, at the hospital, we see three black-eyed children standing outside the entrance to the emergency room. Again, they seem not to be able to walk inside without being invited, but a paramedic walks by and says, "Hey, you kids, either come inside or get out of the way," and then they're able to walk inside. And as they do, they head up to the elevator to Riley's room. And Michael is one of the kids who walks inside Riley's room and pulls back his hood and asks his sister, "Have you missed me?" And that's the way issue 3 ends. Issue 4 picks up with Officer Jones returning home to his own house, thinking that all the things that he's seen couldn't really be real. People just don't die that way. And he's thinking back to all the horrors he's seen over the past couple of days. And as he walks inside, thinking about what a hell of a week it's been, he calls out to his wife, Jen, to tell her that Jen's not going to believe the day he had, and then remembers in a flashback here, it's expert storytelling in just a few panels, maybe two panels, we see Officer Jones drinking heavily, and we see his wife leaving him behind. So despite any efforts that Officer Jones is trying to make to stop drinking and get his wife back, today is not a day to skip a drink. And he pours himself a couple of stiff ones and thinks, what the hell is going on in this town? Over at the hospital, as Michael and his two companions are about to enter his sister's room, they're confronted by a doctor saying, "What are you doing up here? This floor is for immediate family only." And the boys all turn to look at the doctor, with Michael saying, "We are family." The doctor's shocked and surprised by their black eyes and starts to try to run away. And one of the other boys says, "Make it quick." And the third companion says, "Keep it quiet." And the doctor attempts to get away. So meanwhile, the other two boys, Michael and the third boy, enter the room, and the third boy pulls out a knife, telling Michael, "You know what must be done. You must atone for your mistake. Let your human side fade away, embrace your destiny, join your new family. Your biological family must die so you can be reborn." And as Michael reaches for the knife, the third boy has a gun pointed at his head, and it's Jim telling him to drop the knife because no one is going to hurt his baby girl. Meanwhile, down the hall, a nurse is entering a supply closet, and as she does, she sees the other black-eyed child doing something to the doctor, and we see the doctor's in pretty bad shape. His blood vessels seem to be very close to his skin, his pupils have gone white, and his clothes are torn from his body, and the black-eyed boy turns to the nurse and says, "Please come in." Meanwhile, back in the hospital room, Jim tells the boy to not to move or he'll blow his head off. And the boy says, "It's nice, Michael, your family's all here, at least the ones that are still breathing, although your sister's using a machine to breathe, so I don't know if that counts." And as he says this, he reaches back behind and with no effort whatsoever, snaps Jim's wrist as he tells Jim that guns are useless against them. In Officer Jones' house, we still see him drinking from a glass, trying to make sense of the day and the crazy events that have been happening over the past few days. And the phone rings and startles him to the point where he shatters the glass in his hand. And it seems like it's his precinct calling, asking him about his report, probably wondering about the strangeness of it. And he says, "Okay, I'll take care of it first thing in the morning. But can we finish this when I come in tomorrow? Because I just cut my hand very badly and I need to head to the emergency room." Back in Riley's room, Michael now has the knife in his hand. And Jim is trying to reach him and says, "You don't have to do this. Remember who you are. You're not this person. Please remember." And Laura thinks about something else that she picked up at the pawn shop that she wants to try. She pulls out a crucifix and tells them both to stay back. And the third boy laughs and says, "We aren't vampires. Your cross doesn't affect us." And Laura's response to that is, "Fine by me," as she flips the crucifix around, gripping it by its crossbar, and stabs the boy through the throat. He then collapses onto the ground. And Jim once again tries to reach Michael with reason, saying, "Remember who you are. I'm your family. We're your family. I may not have always been there for you before, but I'm here for you now." And Michael's response is, "I remember." I remember that you must die. But before he can take another step, there's a metal hospital tray that clangs him on the back of the head. We see Riley has awakened. She's very unsteady on her feet, holding the teddy bear. And as she takes a step toward Jim and Laura, she collapses. So they run toward her. They help her to her feet. And Jim says, "It's okay, Riley. We're going to get you to safety." And they begin to leave. And Laura says, "What about Michael?" And Jim's response is, "We've got to leave him. It might look like my son, but my son is dead." But as they reach the door, the third black-eyed child has returned from his work with the nurse and the doctor. And he's blocking the doorway. But another hulking figure appears behind him and snaps his neck. Then he pulls out a very large Bowie knife, tells Jim, Laura, and Riley they might want to look away because they may not want to see this, as he cuts the eyes out of the head of the third black-eyed child. He then says, "There will be others soon. We need to leave. Get some blankets and bandages. Your daughter's going to need her bandages changed soon." Jim wants to know who he is. And the man responds, "I'm no one you know, so don't worry about it. But the important thing is I knew your ex-wife." And Jim begins to tell him that his ex-wife, Jessica, is dead. And the man responds, "Yeah, I know. Sorry, I hear she was a sweet kid." And Jim's surprised and says, "Oh, you knew her." And he said, "Let's just say I was a friend of her parents, but we can talk about this at a better time. And now is not that time," as he looks out the window to see more children, more black-eyed kids approaching the hospital. So as all three, all four actually, Riley, Jim, Laura, and this mystery man leave the hospital, they pass Officer Jones, who's walking into the emergency room. As the man says, "Walk with a purpose, look no one in the face." And Jim says, "We did it, Laura, we're together again. It seems like everything is going to be okay." Issue 5 starts off with a look inside the juvenile detention facility where the boy who did the shooting at the convenience store is. And we see a couple of inmates attacking a third boy. It seems that one of the boys believes that the third boy ratted out his cell phone. And as he's about to punch the boy he believes sold him out, we see a hand grab his wrist and snap it effortlessly. It's the boy from the convenience store, and he's there to recruit more people, apparently, as the gang says, "You know, let us go. We won't say anything to anybody. We promise, dude." And the boy, the black-eyed kid, says, "I have no doubt." So we see behind him, he's already begun his recruitment, including the bully that he confronted last issue. And it seems like perhaps that's why he went into the juvenile facility into the first place, to recruit more muscle, as it were. So meanwhile, at the hospital, a nurse is telling Officer Hudson, Randy, that he's got quite a cut there. And the nurse says, "All right, well, we'll get you fixed up in no time. Officers of the law get priority, especially good-looking ones." And begins to touch his hand. He pulls it away saying, "I'm sorry, but it's too soon. You know, his wife had just left." And the nurse says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean." But before she can even finish her sentence, there's a scream. A nurse has seen the wreckage on the previous wing of the hospital, A nurse has discovered the carnage in Riley's room, and as the nurse and Officer Hudson head over, Officer Hudson draws his weapon. He walks past the nurse and the doctor who were killed by the black-eyed children. He sees the two bodies of those black-eyed children in Riley's room. As he hears a voice saying, "You shouldn't be here, you're not wanted here, and I suggest you leave, you might even consider running." He pulls his gun out, says, "Don't move, tell me what you're doing here." And he says, "What am I doing here? I'm waiting, of course." And we see it's Michael. And Officer Hudson wants to know what he's waiting on. And he says, "For him, of course. He's been waiting for the one that got stabbed in the neck with the crucifix to rise." And Officer Hudson is not believing this is possible, tells him, "Stay where you are." And Michael then grabs the gun, saying, "You made a mistake, officer. I told you to run," and flings him across the room, and then leaves along with the other child. Meanwhile, Meredith is sleeping on her cot in the barn where the black-eyed kids seem to make their headquarters. She then awakens and grabs the pencil from her side table, approaches the leader from behind, raising the pencil above her head. Looks like she's about to stab him when, without turning around, he says, "Haven't we been down this path before, Meredith? I made it pretty clear where I stand on your behavior." And he's decided that a journal will be the best way for Meredith to chronicle the downfall of man. Such an intimate touch, right? Word should come from your hands, not from a cold, lifeless machine. Now sit and start to write, because Meredith, you're not stupid. You know that your writing ability is not the only reason you were brought to me. And in fact, it's just an added bonus. You've sensed that, right? And Meredith's like, "Yeah, I know. It's got to be something to do with those dreams, right?" And the boy says, "Yes, the one you recently had with Ricky, was it?" And the boy says, "Yeah, it's not a dream. It's a memory that's been suppressed." And we'll talk more of these dreams and memories, because right now you only vaguely remember them, right? And Meredith says, "Where are you going with this?" And the boy says, "Well, there are things that you no longer remember, that you only remember in your dreams. And we've got to help you remember those things, because I want you to remember everything and everyone." And the boy then approaches her and says, "Focus, concentrate, remember." And Meredith has another flashback. She sees that boy, Ricky. She sees her father. She sees a lot of children, and she sees a boy rise out of some black water and walk out of the lake, or of this blackness, whatever it is. And she sees, as the boy emerges, that it is that same boy, that same leader of the black-eyed kids. And as Meredith has remembered this in the present time, that leader says, "So, Meredith, do you remember me now?" Clearly, they have met before. Meanwhile, back at the juvenile facility, we see a couple of guards approach the boy who has been recruiting members to the black-eyed kids in juvenile facility. The boy that did the shooting at the convenience store, we find out his name is Simmons. And they tell him, "On your feet, there's two kids in the infirmary, and we believe you're responsible for it." And the one who's been able to talk is, "I ID'd you," as he smacks him with a nightstick. And they say, "We knew it was a mistake to let you in with the general population." And as the boy looks up at him, he has normal eyes, which is very strange. And because he then says, "Speaking of mistakes, you just made your last." And his eyes then shift to the black-eyed pupils. So seems like there's something different about him, because even in the word balloon, the way the word balloon is rendered, it seems like he's speaking in two different voices. So after he tells them that we might have found you useful, instead now they'll just find you dead, as all of a sudden his recruits show up in the doorway of his cell. And that's the way issue 5 ends. So it's a really fast-paced story. It's really compelling. It's dark. It's mystery-driven. You know, we don't know the origin of these black-eyed kids. We don't know Meredith's connection, but clearly there is one. We don't know exactly what's going on with the Simmons. He seems to be somewhat of a leader, maybe second in charge after the other young blonde boy. Why Jim's family? What's so important about Jim's family that we're getting the narrative of him? Who is the man who helped save Jim's family? What's his connection to Jessica? There's so many questions yet to be answered. But what I really love about the story more than anything, beyond those compelling elements and the mystery that's building that you want answers to, it's a couple things. It's the relationship to the characters. It's these characters being put in extreme situations and the realistic way that Pruitt has them react and the realistic way that Krodansky depicts that. And more than anything about the story, what makes it so creepy is the color work of Guy Major. It's some of the best color work I've ever seen because it's scary, right? It's creepy. It's dark. It's cold. There's snow on the ground, and there's often a mist that permeates everything, and it just helps set the mood so, so well. And you couple that color work with Krodansky's art, which is very expressive, especially in the faces. And it's especially impressive to me that he's able to have these faces be so expressive when there's no actual eyes, because the eyes are often what is conveying so much emotion, right? And so it's expertly done graphic storytelling. It's, as I said, paced quickly. And sometimes when stories are paced as quickly as a story like this is, it can feel choppy. It can feel like you're missing out on things, or it's moving too fast and you're skipping over useful information. Kudos to Joe Pruitt for keeping a fast-paced, taut, suspenseful story without feeling like you're missing out on anything. So it's a great job both of narrative and a story that's well-paced and told, and you know, the dialogue's realistic and it's not hokey, which is another danger with horror comics. But the other thing is how smoothly the transitions are from panel to panel, and what a great job of storytelling and visuals that Krodansky gives, from moving the angle of the camera around in the panels to the use of extreme close-up and splash pages for impact when it's needed, and just really great artistic choices. You know, things like when the hulking mystery man shows up and cuts the black eyes out of the head of one of the black-eyed kids, and then the next panel we get is just this extreme close-up of him holding these eyes in his hands. There's so many different ways he could have chosen to depict that on the page. And the choices he makes artistically are just incredible. And I don't know how detailed of a script he's working from, so I don't know how much of that is Krodansky and how much of that is Pruitt calling out, here's exactly what I want in this panel. I imagine it's a bit of both. That's usually when you see the best kind of stories unfold, and stories are so seamless with transitions from panel to panel and narration and, you know, graphic storytelling versus the way the dialogue flows. Oftentimes those are the stories where the creative team, the writer and the artist are in, completely in sync, and they're so on the same page that it just seems effortless. So I really, really recommend this story. It's one of the best from Aftershock, and it's so taut. I think it rivals The Walking Dead in terms of how compelling it is, and how as soon as you finish one issue, you immediately want to read the next. I mean, it's just a really, really great story. So it's one I've wanted to talk about on the podcast for quite a while. And I have talked to Joe Pruitt about it in person at Denver Comic Con, and I'm hoping to get some more Black Eyed Kids in the future, but there's nothing currently planned. I think there are 3 volumes out in total. 2 or 3, I can't remember. But there's more to the story and more to come, hopefully at some point down the line. But don't let the fact that the story hasn't been completed prevent you from picking up the volumes that are out there, because it is such a great great story and a great read. And by picking up the trades of Black Eyed Kids that are already out there, that's the way you can show Joe and the rest of Aftershock that we really do want more of this title. And again, the art is second to none. Great job with the color work by Guy Major to help set the tone and the mood. And yeah, this is just, it's one of my favorite Aftershock titles. It's a story that I can read over and over again because it is just so, so good. I could see it on the small screen as well. It would make for a great Netflix show, if nothing else. So do yourself a favor, pick up Black Eyed Kids if you haven't checked it out yet. The first volume has these five issues that I covered in this episode. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially five-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.